Okay, this is the third on the subject of chosenness and equality. Okay, let's review where we're up to, and today I'll try to finish. We're talking about the chosen people, what it means to be chosen. And I started with a review of the idea of equality. Since chosen, it seems to violate equality. I pointed out that there are two uses of the concept of equality. One is descriptive, that people in fact are equal to one another. And that's obviously true in some respects and obviously false in other respects. No one thinks all people are all equal in all respects. Nobody thinks that. So, no one could oppose chosenness on the grounds that if you think this group is chosen, you think they're different, and nobody's different, because nobody thinks that everybody's exactly the same. Second use of the concept is normative. People should be treated the same. No one thinks that either. No one thinks all people should be treated the same. We all believe that there should be distinctions made between people in how they're treated. Voting rights and welfare and drafting into the army, and we don't expect everyone to be treated the same. And therefore, one cannot oppose chosenness on the grounds that if a group is chosen, it has different rights and responsibilities from everybody else. And that can't be accepted because everyone should always be treated the same. No one believes that. The only opposition you could have to chosenness on grounds of equality is if chosenness implies a particular type of difference or a particular type of responsibility or a particular privilege, and then you could argue in detail against that particular respect of difference or respect of responsibility or privilege. But a general philosophical principle, we believe in equality, chosenness means inequality, and therefore we oppose it. Such an opposition is incompetent because no one holds a principle across the board that people are equal nor that people should be treated equal. Then we said that to describe chosenness as merely having a different challenge, a different job, a different contribution to make is not acceptable. First of all, because Jewish sources don't limit themselves to simply saying we have special responsibilities. And even more, God assigns a responsibility to a group on the grounds that that group is best able to carry it out. Different groups have different abilities, different talents, different weaknesses, different shortcomings. To choose a particular group and say that this group has the responsibility of living the Torah means that this group is best suited to living the Torah. So the difference in treatment is based on a difference in their characteristics, which is the way difference in treatment should be based. It should be based on difference in characteristics, relevant difference in characteristics. So we said we need to describe in what way the Jewish people is unique, what makes them different from everybody else. And I started that last Thursday, by describing to you a concept of value. This concept of value is not familiar. It's not something that you know from any place else, I'm quite sure. It's not commonly discussed in philosophy anymore. I saw it in Sidgwick's Methods of Ethics, but that was over 120 years ago that it was written. The difference, the distinction is between comparative value versus non-comparative value. By comparative value, we mean that something is better than its contrast. Very often, when we say something's good, what we mean is it's better than its contrast. We say health is good. What we mean is, it's better to be healthy than to be ill. When we say education is good, we mean it's better to be educated than to be ignorant. We say wealth is good, if we do say it. What we mean is, it's better to be wealthy than to be poor or middle class. Saying something is good very often means that it's better than its contrast. One could imagine another type of value where when I say it's good, I don't mean only that it's better than its contrast. I mean that it's good in and of itself without consideration of its better being better than its contrast. Now that's a little hard to understand. If I'm talking about X, I'm talking about X as being good. Of course, if I have X, I don't have its contrast. They're incompatible. So how can I say, well, I'm telling you X is good, but I don't mean that it's better than its contrast. I mean that it's good independently of its being ruling out its contrast. If you have X, you know that it rules out its contrast. How can you detach your mind from the comparison? So I gave two examples last time, but because one of them was misapplied, I'll only give one. But the idea and the first application belong to Rabbi Nachum Lansky of Neir Yisrael in Baltimore. I'm using my application. It's logically identical to his, except that it doesn't generate a spurious misunderstanding. Imagine contemplating the end of the human race. There's an atomic war, and the human race is going to disappear. Imagine someone says, the end of the human race, what a tragedy. Now we ask him, end of the human race is a tragedy, why? What's so terrible about the end of all people? And he says, imagine that he says, well, if people disappear, X will disappear. Losing X is a terrible tragedy. When he says X will disappear with the end of the human race, usually that will mean that X will disappear and its contrast will also disappear. They'll both disappear. If they're both going to disappear and he's mourning the loss of X, he can't be saying merely that X is better than its contrast because we're losing X and its contrast. To say that the end of the human race is a tragedy because X will be lost means I'm giving X a value above and beyond its just being better than its contrast. That's a way to understand the concept. I haven't said what it applies to yet, but to understand the concept of non-comparative value. Under those conditions, if you imagine someone said, the end of the human race will be a tragedy. Why? Because there'll be no more love. Love is so important, so valuable, so significant. The loss of love to the universe would make the universe a poorer place. Now, of course, the end of the human race means you're going to lose love and you're going to lose hate also. You're going to lose both of them. So to say that it's a terrible loss can't mean just that love is better than hate. Because now you're contrasting having love versus having neither love nor hate. It's not love versus hate, it's love versus nothing. That contrast means you're valuing love above and beyond its being better than hate. That's what I would call a non-comparative value. Now, in logic, the difference between comparative values on the one hand and non-comparative values on the other hand is this. With comparative values, you can justify or criticize the state a thing is in. If a person's healthy, that's good. If he's ill, that's bad. Why? Because health is better than illness. So given the person exists, then you can talk about whether he's in a good state or a bad state by knowing that health is better than illness. If all you know is that health is better than illness, you can't use that to explain why he should exist at all. To say he should exist because he's healthy is a disconnect. If he exists, then being healthy is better than being ill. So if he's healthy, he's in a good state. If he's ill, he's in a worse state. But if he ceases to exist, then he'll be neither healthy nor ill. Or if all I know is that health is better than illness, then his death is no tragedy. Because then you have neither health nor illness. To mourn a person's death, there has to be something about him that's good above and beyond simply being better than its opposite. And similarly with respect to the human race as a whole. And non-comparative value can be used to justify a thing's existence. A comparative value can be used to justify or criticize a thing's state, the condition that it's in, but not its very existence. I don't mean to say that there are bigger values or smaller values. That has nothing to do with being bigger or smaller. It's a logical category, and it applies to a particular type of question. There can be very big comparative values, and there may be rather small non-comparative values. It's not a question of large and small. It's not a question of taking precedence one over the other. It's simply a question of what their content is and what they can be used for to justify. Now, this is where we ended last time. One way of putting the uniqueness of the Jewish people and its challenge is this. The Torah bids us realize, express, create non-comparative value. And we are uniquely suited to a life that is dedicated to creating non-comparative value. That's what makes us different. That's the unique nature of the Jewish challenge. And that's what makes us different. And as I said at that time, it's only my formulation. And because I'm a philosopher, that's the way I do it. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it. There may be other ways that are easier or simpler or more insightful for other purposes. But I think this is one correct way of doing it. But this is the way Rabbi Lansky did it. Now, what is it that has non-comparative value? Here, all I can do is appeal to intuitions, because ultimately in ethics, all you get is intuitions. At least the way ethics is done today. There's nothing more authoritative than meditating on the idea and comparing it and contrasting with other ideas and trying to make it consistent and seeing whether it makes sense or doesn't make sense. Health does not seem to be a non-comparative value. Mourning the passing of the human race, all those LA fitness clubs are gone. Psh, what a tragedy. You know, it's hard to work oneself into a state where the passing of the human race is a tragedy, because there'll be no more LA fitness clubs. Or there'll be no more Fortune 500 companies. Or there'll be no more wealthy people. Or there'll be no more protoplasmic information storage systems. Right? Educated brains. If you have a human race functioning, then education is important and health is important and wealth may be important, because the human race is functioning, and these are comparative states that they may be in, and some states are better than other states. But when it passes from the scene, you know, then the fact that you don't have the positive side, you don't have the negative side either. You have neither of them. It doesn't seem to be a real motivation for mourning the passing of the human race. Now, Rabbi Lansky said there is such a quality, and that is a particular moral spiritual excellence. A certain type of quality of being, of action, of intention, will, feeling, attitude that human beings can display. And it's that quality of life, that particular moral spiritual excellence, that is a non-comparative value. And it is that particular moral spiritual excellence that the Torah is designed to have us create. What quality is that? So here you're talking about a quality of living. I don't think it's possible to give it an abstract definition. The best we could do is consider instances of it so that the common thread will be communicated. Any words that we use are going to be too vague and too relative to different cultural traditions to communicate clearly, I think. And here are a few instances which may give an insight into the idea. Rav Moshe Feinstein was one of the greatest scholars and outstandingly pious people in the previous century, who was once being driven to his yeshiva in New York. And when he arrived, someone opened the door of the car for him to get out of the passenger side. He did. And then the fellow closed the door, catching Rav Moshe's fingers inside the door. So, Rav Moshe quickly opened the door and put his hand in his jacket and walked into the building. Someone who observed this took him aside and examined his hand and got first aid for him. I mean, his fingers were mangled. And someone asked him, Rav Moshe, your fingers were mangled in the door. Why didn't you cry out in pain? And he said, I didn't want to embarrass the person who closed the door. Now let's think what that means. Number one, he felt the pain. We don't lie on beds of nails or roll in the snow to inure ourselves to pain. He definitely felt the pain. Furthermore, it was totally unexpected. When you go to the dentist, you make up your mind, I'm not going to be a baby on the chair. I'll screw up my courage and I won't wince and flinch and yell. But this is totally unexpected, excruciating pain. But his immediate impulse was, is he going to be embarrassed? That's where his thoughts were. His thoughts were more with the other person's embarrassment than with his own pain. Now that's outstanding. I can't imagine that happening to me. Though I want to point out to you that it's a psychological condition which we could imagine. Imagine yourself in a concert and the music is very soft, and someone steps into your row and steps on your foot really hard, totally unexpected. Are you going to yell? Maybe not. Maybe you'll be conscious of the fact that if I yell at the 3,000 people who are listening to the music, I'm going to attract some very negative attention. So you might indeed reflexively stop the yell in your throat because you're in a concert and it's quiet and you can understand the consequences. But here, Rav Moshe is focused on the consequences continuously. There's another human being. If I yell, what's going to happen? That's his first thought. That's an involvement with the other person, which is a moral, spiritual excellence. Another story comes to down to us. Two stories about pain. In the First World War, the Moses Rebbe of that time had to have an operation. He had to have his leg amputated. And there was no anesthesia. It was wartime. And he composed a 64-part musical composition during the operation. Rabbi Naftali Amsterdam, one of the great Musar leaders, had to have an abdominal operation. Anesthesia was available, and he refused it on the grounds that he was working on a Talmudic problem and didn't want to be interrupted. Both of them were able to maintain their focus in spite of excruciating pain. That's an ability to focus on something spiritual and to somehow be able to block out the pain that would normally be filling one's consciousness. Now here too, we can make contact with somewhat ordinary experiences. People who play sports can injure themselves, and they don't know that they're injured until the game is over. When the game is over, the injury is very painful. But while they're in the focus of the sport, they simply don't feel it. They don't feel it. It happened to me in a minor way, and I experienced it that way. I was on the wrestling team, and as it turned out, I broke the big toe of one foot in the middle of the match. I didn't feel anything until the match was over. That leg refused to push. I guess it was a kind of instinctive protection so it shouldn't be damaged anymore. It wouldn't push. And my teammates were saying, pin him, pin him. And I said, I'm trying, but this leg won't push. It was just very, like paralyzed. It just wouldn't give. After it was over, the bell rang, the pain was excruciating. I didn't feel anything until the bell rang. Okay, so that can happen. You can be up for a particular experience and not feel things in another dimension. But here's a person who can undergo a major operation and simply turn it off. Turn it off by focusing on something spiritual. This is a kind of moral spiritual excellence that that's the Torah bids us develop. I'll give you one more example. Now, I don't know if you can relate to this directly. If you can't, remember it, think about it. It's on a very awesome level. In one of the concentration camps during the Second World War, there were shipments of people to the death camps. They had lists. A man came to the Rav, the rabbi of the group, and he said, "My son is on the list. I have money. I can bribe one of the guards to get him out. But we all know that the Nazis have a limit. They have a number. And if they don't find the person who's on the list, they'll take somebody else. Am I allowed to rescue my son, knowing that if I do so, someone else is going to be chosen?" And the Rav said, we have his response. The Rav wrote this up after the war. The Rav said, "I don't have books here to consult. I don't have colleagues to take counsel with. I can't answer you." And the father said, "You have to answer me. I have to do it now. The decision has to be made now." And the Rav refused to answer. Couldn't take responsibility for the decision. And the father said, "If you can't answer me, it means it's not clear in your mind that I'm allowed to save my son. Then I will not save my son." That's awesome. It's awesome on moral grounds. It's awesome on spiritual grounds. It's an awesome, may we never be tested to put in such a position, but it's an awesome performance. And this person, I don't know if we even know his name. He's a Jew. Now, every law in the Torah is designed to develop, to express, to create this kind of moral spiritual excellence. Sometimes it's obvious and sometimes it isn't obvious. If it isn't obvious, it just means you have to do more research into understanding what the law does. I'll give you an example where it's obvious, an example where it isn't obvious, and I'll tell you why it is so. You lend money to somebody. Now, if you make a personal loan, then there's no interest. That's already a considerable favor because you could have been using that money to make money or do other things with it, and you're depriving yourself of that profit. So you're already giving him a considerable gift. Time comes to repay the loan, and he can't repay. Now, you're walking down the street, and you see him coming up the street towards you. You have to cross to the other side of the street. Because maybe if he sees you coming towards him, he'll be embarrassed that he hasn't paid up the money. So it's not enough that you have to extend yourself to make money available to people at no charge. But in addition, you have to worry about how they're going to feel if they haven't paid you the money back on time. That's a very high moral level. It's a very high moral level. Similarly, the Torah tells us someone asks you for charity, it's not enough just to give him money. You have to empathize, and you have to show them that you empathize. There are two verses. One says, don't tighten your fist, and the other says, don't harden your heart. One of the commentators asks, if I've already been told not to tighten my fist, it means I have to give. Why then tell me that I shouldn't harden my heart? The answer is that in addition to giving, you have to be heart to heart with him. You have to show him that you empathize with him. So here you have levels of moral and spiritual excellence that the Torah requires of us. What about studying Gemara? Those musty old tomes authored by our Iraqi ancestors 1,500 years ago. Okay, they're not musty, and the new editions of Shas coming out every year, and they're not very advanced, and so forth and so on. I'm just joking. What moral spiritual excellence is there in studying the Talmud? Well, here's one aspect. The Gemara in the Dorim tells us that were it to occur one moment without any Torah study, the entire universe would cease to exist. Were it not for my covenant day and night, the laws of heaven and earth I would not have placed. My covenant day and night, all the time. That means whenever a person is studying Torah, he is contributing to the existence of the universe. So, coal miners in Shanghai and tuna fishermen, Japanese tuna fishermen in the Pacific Ocean, and the Eskimos doing whatever Eskimos do, not to mention the South Africans doing whatever South Africans do. All of them are being benefited by our learning Torah. And our son who lives in Lakewood reported to me a couple of years ago that Rav Matisyahu Solomon, who is the Mashgiach in Lakewood Yeshiva, said, one of the things you should have in mind when you learn Torah is that you are contributing to the existence of the universe as a whole. Studying Torah has to be experienced as interpersonal, a responsibility for the universe and mankind as a whole. So, what looks like a disconnected academic gesture turns out to have exquisite interpersonal effect. And a person should think about that. That's what one of the reasons he's doing it. One of the purposes in so doing. The Midrash says that had the non-Jewish world appreciated what the temple in Jerusalem was doing for them, not only would they not have destroyed it, but they would have created legions around it to protect it from all harm. The service of the Jews in the temple changes the spiritual character of the world as a whole. And everybody benefits from it. So the bottom line is that the Torah gives us the challenge, the responsibility, and the means to create non-comparative value. So we can say to God, listen, given that there are people, there are lots of comparative values, but that there should be people at all, that there should be a creation at all, that it should be worth it in toto, that's what we're creating. We're creating that reality. Now, this is not to say that other people don't have a share in this. The non-Jewish world has mitzvot also. They have commandments that they are bound by also. But it's not their main focus. It doesn't take up the sum total of their time. It's a framework within which they do everything else. Not murdering and not stealing and justice, pursuing justice. But within that, you can spend 12 hours a day being a scientist, or 12 hours a day being a football player, or 12 hours a day being a soldier. The Jewish people are chosen to have this as their total focus, the total focus of bringing non-comparative value into the world. Now, let's ask what I think is the key question that bothers people here. Does that mean that we are better than other people? Does chosenness imply that we're better than other people? Here I, with some regret, I have to play the philosopher's game and give you three different meanings or applications of better, and we'll treat them one at a time, because otherwise we cannot get clear on this. You can talk about being better in aptitude. You can talk about being better in performance. And you can talk about being better in terms of merit. These are three different applications. None of them implies the others. I'll explain the differences between them to you, and then we'll answer the questions one at a time. Greater aptitude says nothing about performance. There are people who waste their talents. They have great aptitude, they do nothing with it. On the other hand, there are people with, I would say, mediocre aptitude whose performances are outstanding. They simply are very focused, very hardworking, very responsible, and they produce an outstanding performance, even though, in terms of innate talent, their talent is mediocre. So aptitude and performance don't correspond necessarily. Merit depends only on effort. You don't get more merit because you're more talented. and therefore your performance doesn't determine your merit. The only thing that determines merit is effort. So these are really three different concepts. There's superiority of aptitude, superiority of performance, and superiority of merit. Now, quiz time. Given what I've told you about chosenness, does chosenness imply superiority in any of these three areas? Does chosenness imply superiority in any of these three areas? Yes, it does. Where does it?
Ability.
Right. Superiority of aptitude. In particular, as we said, a superior aptitude for implementing non-comparative value. That's why the challenge of creating non-comparative value was given to us, because we have a superior ability to do that. But it doesn't imply superiority of performance, and it doesn't imply superiority of merit. And I think recognizing superiority of aptitude shouldn't be a philosophical stumbling block. Everybody knows that different people have different aptitudes and different groups have different aptitudes. So to say, oh, look at that, you're implying superiority, we can't accept that. One would want to have some reason for taking such a position, since everybody knows that different groups have different aptitudes for different things. Yeah?
So then what you're saying is theoretically we're not any better off than Jews. We just happen to have certain things and we have to use our things for the good of us, but if we look home and we don't use it for the good, then it's like for example, someone who's poor, you know, as I say, the rich got richer. So if he goes and he got richer, so he had money to play with, therefore, whereas in someone who's poor and, you know, he was careful with what he did, and he struggled and he worked hard, so he's much more appreciated. You have to give him much more credit. So in the sense of a Jew who goes and he doesn't do what he was supposed to, what he was chosen to do, so therefore he's just like any non-Jew.
A Jew who does not use what he has will be treated. In fact, the prophets speak that way exactly. God says, aren't you just like these non-Jewish nations to me? When they failed, I did this to them. When you fail, I'll do the same to you. Absolutely. Absolutely. But you see, just try to be careful with the way you use the words. I just now said that superiority has three different applications. And you said better than without indicating which one it was. That's a recipe for disaster. Because then in your mind, you slip from one to the other. Right? So you better be just, when you talk about better than, say what kind of better you mean. Right? Also, I only talked about the implications of chosenness. There may be other items in the tradition that talk about these matters of superiority, but as far as chosenness is concerned, all chosenness implies is superiority of aptitude for this particular task, and nothing else. Now, finally, if we are different in this way, how do we get to be that way? Where does the difference come from, this unique Jewish national character that we have, the ability, a superior ability to implement this this non-comparative value? National character in general is formed by a combination of two factors. Number one, there's historical experience. Obviously, the experiences that a nation undergoes, especially if they are large scale and of long duration, like slavery in Egypt, which lasted for about 90 years, or being a foreign nation, which lasted for 210 years, that's going to leave a mark on the national psyche. But that's not enough. It's not enough that you have a certain type of experience, because two nations can have the identical events occur, and they'll affect the nations entirely different ways. You can have two nations that are devastated in war. One resolves to become pacifist, and the other resolves to have a stronger army next time. So you have to indicate also the original characteristics that the population had, which it brought to the historical process, and it's the combination of both factors which leads to the developing national character. Now, in our case, we started with the patriarchs and the matriarchs. Each of them contributed certain fundamental characteristics. those characteristics from those seven become the reservoir of elements of character that the people as a whole possess. That reservoir then is modified by the experiences that the nation undergoes, and that's how national character is produced. And that's why we have the character that we do. A detailed analysis would have to go back to the patriarchs and matriarchs and ask what each one contributed, and then to see how the experiences that we went through affected that original stock of characteristics. Yeah. Well, I don't see the relationship between the two questions. The first question is, So, I don't know what more to say about the first question I said before. You're asking, why should anyone care if we say we're superior? If the other person is self-confident and comfortable with his own identity, he shouldn't care. I don't know, if he's nervous that he doesn't really have the truth, then he might care because it's going to point out that he's missing something. But if he really thinks that he's, he is what he needs to be, it shouldn't bother him at all. In the way that it doesn't bother us, that there are other nations, other cultures, other religions, which have an entirely different picture of the world, it doesn't bother us, except we feel sorry for them that they don't have the truth. Right? So I don't know what more to say than it shouldn't bother them. And if someone who is not a Jew becomes convinced that we do have the truth and this really is a superior position, it's open to him to join. So I can't see where the trouble would come from unless the person is having difficulty in his own self-confidence. Now, the second question?
Which is that, why should Ger, oh, that he hasn't been through all these experiences and so forth?
So, we're talking now about why God chose us, that is to say, chose us as a nation and imposed it upon us. He imposed it upon us because as a nation we possess these characteristics. It doesn't mean that no other person could have, now we have to be careful, he wouldn't have all of the characteristics, he wouldn't have them in a fully developed state. When he becomes a convert, he changes. Something essential changes in him. But
the experiences that he's been through changes?
No, it's not that. It's he's given a measure of soul that he didn't have before. But he's in a position where when he receives that extra measure of soul, then the experiences that he had will, together with that measure of soul, give him the appropriate character to join the nation as a whole. And by the way, having said this, let me, I see from your question that I'm leaving this with a slight ambiguity. These characteristics are possessed by the nation as a whole. I'm not saying that each individual Jew has the same fund of characteristics. A little bit like an artist who has a palette. He may have five basic colors. He can paint a whole range of hues on the canvas by mixing the colors. On the other hand, if he has five basic colors, there may be hues that he can't paint. There may be hues that he can't get. Or if he makes combinations will have certain characteristic. If you have to mix blue and yellow to make green, you need twice as much paint as against having an original green paint. So then it's going to be thicker. It's going to change the composition of the picture. It's going to set up limitations. The nation as a whole possesses these characteristics. Each Jew has a different mixture or a different contribution to the national possession of these characteristics. Yeah.
Chosen, therefore he made us chosen. So So why should someone who doesn't have that in him, who goes and takes whatever he has in him and makes the most of it, why should he be any worse off in the sense of in the world to come than a Jew? In the sense of a guy who keeps the seven mitzvot enough, and he's overall a great person, and he does everything possible, and he just, you know, there are people now that said, yeah, I'm doing what God says, I'm keeping the seven things. Why should, when he comes up in the world to come, why should he not be on the same level, up to par with someone who was given more to start off with and took that further?
Well, the idea of the comparative ultimate conditions of Jews and non-Jews in the world to come is a complicated, complicated issue. It's clear that there's no categorical grading system because, according to many sources, a Jew can act in such a way as to lose his portion of the world to come altogether. That's infinitely worse than a non-Jew who does whatever he does and gets a portion of the world to come. So it simply isn't true that all Jews end up better than all non-Jews. It's much more complicated than that. Now, secondly, you'd have to take into account reincarnation. That soul is the soul of a non-Jew now, but you don't know what it was 13 incarnations ago or 25 incarnations ago. Furthermore, why not?
Is it possible that every soul spends time as a Jew then?
I'm opening that up as a possibility, which means that you wouldn't have that distinction altogether. Furthermore, we are here to make free decisions. It's appropriate for a non-Jew to become a Jew. After all, remember what we said. God tried to reach all of mankind over and over again, without any distinctions, without any caste system, whether it was Adam and Chava in the Garden of Eden, or it was up to the generation of the flood, or from the generation of the flood up to Abraham, or giving it the Torah at Sinai. In all cases, God tried to reach all of mankind equally. Four times, mankind turned his back on their backs, and God said no. Those were choices. We are here to, the world to come is a result of the choices that we made. And now there's another choice. The Jewish people is here, and the opportunity to make the choice is there.
God knew that they were going to say no because they didn't have any.
Now you're sifting to another grounds. And I'm sure that there's an infinity of grounds that we could raise. But let's understand that the question that you raised is being answered. The question of whether or not it's fair in the world to come depends upon the choices that they made. If they were given the opportunity to make the choice, and they chose not to do it, then their portion of the world to come is a consequence of their choice, right?
But the Jewish nation is in the sense of God. What you were saying is that they had something in them more than every other non-Jewish nation.
All I said was that this makes it appropriate to choose them. Not that others couldn't appreciate that this is the right thing to do, but just if you're going to impose it on these people that they have to do it in all their descendants, it has to be that they're the best able to keep it.
I haven't
commented on that. Nothing I have said is relevant to that. I can answer it, but it's not relevant to that. I'm not saying that we got credit for saying yes. I'm saying we were chosen and was imposed upon us because we have the best ability to keep it.
Does that make it easier for us to accept it?
Maybe yes, maybe no, but that's not the issue. The issue is not that.
It makes it harder for the good to accept it.
So what? What's one thing got to do with the other? The fact that there's a comparison between two choices doesn't mean that you're not responsible for the choice.
He's starting off with negative numbers.
So who said they were negative? You just said it was harder. Harder just means that there are easier choices. Right? Not to speed to save my job is harder than not to speed to get to the beach. Does that mean that it's okay to speed to save my job? It's harder than not speeding to the beach. Yeah, but it's still within the realms of what we expect you to obey the law and take the consequences. The fact that there's a harder or easier choice doesn't mean that this one is out of the bounds morally. It's just,
well, we would understand the guy who's speeding. The judge might understand the guy who's speeding to save his job more than he would understand the guy who's
That's another comparative judgment. He could not understand it more, but he'll still find it because he broke the law. That's not an excuse. He might, and he might. But with the driving laws, you don't have, there's no sympathy. There's just there's a fixed rate for the driving laws. My point is, comparative judgments don't support absolute conclusions. A is taller than B. So is B too short? He's just shorter than B. I don't know if he's too short. A comparative judgment doesn't support an absolute conclusion.
Yeah. So, all right, because the Jewish nation is chosen, does that mean that all other nations are also chosen for different reasons? Or are we the only ones that were chosen at all?
That's an interesting question. We use the word chosen, we use it for this particular spiritual position. You're opening up the question of using it more broadly, chosen for various purposes. I think that's right. For example, the reason I'm hesitating is because I won't really be on the same page, because being chosen for a spiritual position is not like being chosen for industry. But I think you're right. For example, the Gemara does say that Babylon was chosen to be the instrument to destroy the Jewish people, the temple, the Jewish state in the first exile, because prior to that time, they were nobodies, and after they destroyed us, they became nobodies. They flourished for a short time and played no other role in history. So as to see it as an instrument that God created specifically for this purpose, and for no other purpose.
Then you get into the entire idea of which one of God's chosen people has a more important job. And if I feel compelled to choose between one chosen people and another chosen people, which one should I choose?
Okay, so, there it might matter. Now, this is what I said before, that the distinction between comparative and non-comparative is not the same as the distinction between more important and less important. I can imagine a non-Jew saying, I can either become a Jew and study Torah, or maybe he's in a unique position to prevent nuclear war. But he can only do that as a non-Jew.
Exactly.
Now, survival...
Well, I don't understand why you could only do it as a non-Jew.
Okay, but I'm trying to make a point. I'm trying to make a point, right? In other words, a person could say that survival is the precondition of realizing any values, including non-comparative values. Surely survival has got to be top of the line. If you thought it was all naturalistic, if you didn't think that God were involved in handling survival, so then you would have a comparative value which is crucial, and a person might say that's more important. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I'm saying now. You see, the trouble is that the points are not separate. The values are not separate. The more of the non-comparative value you have, the more divine providence there is to handle the other matters as well.
Exactly.
So if that being the case, contributing to the non-comparative value automatically means making a contribution to the non-comparative as well. They're linked. So it isn't really a choice like that. You set up a choice with either this or that. And like the Gemara says about something else, it's not A or B, it's rather A versus A and B.
Exactly.
If so, then it's clear that...
You should choose A and B.
That's correct. Okay. Right. I think that's closer to it.
You should always maximize your talents in as many ways possible.
No. The ways in which you maximize, develop your talents are not neutral. Some are more valuable, some are less valuable. Okay. A person could be a surgeon and a prize fighter. Should he divide his time 50-50? I don't think so. He should give up prize fighting.
Well, assuming that the things that you're doing are all,
of equal value?
Of a relatively equal value.
If so, then you should flip a coin. Who says it's better to have variety? If A and B are two things that I can do and they're of equal value, and my choice is 50-50 or 100% A, who says 50-50 is better than 100% A? So if that's the case,
So then how does Judaism teach us to make the choice?
In cases where the alternatives are of equal value, you can flip a coin. Life is like that, right?
Yeah.
Life is like that. When you decide that going to the hockey game and reading Shakespeare are of really equal value to you, then the right thing to do is flip a coin and go ahead. Right? I just want to comment on this and I've got to quit. Sometimes people are excruciatingly disturbed by a decision because they can't figure out which alternative is better. Under those conditions, the decision is easy. It's trivial.
Yeah.
Because if you can't see any clear superiority, one over the other, then choose either one. It makes no difference. And people feel, but I don't know what to do. The thing to do is flip a coin. That's not the hard case. The hard cases are where you're too ignorant about them, you don't know what they're. Then you could do some research and find out what they are. Right? But if they really are that close in their significance.
Each one can have its pluses and its minuses, so you're not sure which ones are more than
another. Okay. Why are you not sure? Because you can't weigh them up.
Yeah.
If you can't weigh them up, then flip a coin. So it seems to be.
Or it takes seven breaths.